when women need to do things that require action, which surgery often does, people don't always respond to them.
You are listening to Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories, a podcast about surgeon scientists, the things they care about,
and why it matters to you.
We're not superhuman.
You don't have time to specialize in both things at once.
The more I learned about it, the more I recognized that this needed to be brought to the forefront.
When you get a bad outcome, how do you manage your own emotions?
That feeling that you get when the patients say thank you, that's why I do it.
Join the conversation. This is Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories. Hi, I'm David for the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery. The Me Too movement continues to highlight persistent gender inequality across America. Women in the workplace often face higher expectations and are paid less than men. How is this problem expressed in the medical profession? And what can we do about it? That was the topic of my conversation with Dr. Caprice Christian Greenberg. Dr. Greenberg is a professor of surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she specializes in breast cancer treatment. I spoke with Dr. Greenberg on the campus of the University of Minnesota as she was preparing to deliver the David A. Rothenberger lecture entitled Sticky Floors and Glass Ceilings.
Four years ago, I was invited to give a talk by a professor whose lab I worked in when I was a medical school student at the University of Chicago named John Alverdi. And he wanted me to give a talk and he gave me a title. And he said, the 21st century surgeon, who is she and where is she taking us? And so I gave a talk that was very broad and talked about changes that I saw coming in surgery. And one part of that was focused on gender. And as I did the research for that talk, I realized what a big problem we had, and a problem that I didn't even recognize the magnitude of, despite being a woman in surgery. And so the more I learned about it, the more I recognized that this was really something that needed to be brought to the forefront and people really needed to have much more awareness of. And I was very fortunate that about 3 years later, I was the president of the Association for Academic Surgery, which is the biggest academic surgery society in the country, and had a presidential address to give. And so I actually ended up dropping most of the other stuff about where we were going in the next century and focusing very specifically on the issues around gender equity.
So, Dr. Greenberg, what is the big problem with gender equity in the surgical specialty?
So there's really several issues that primarily relate to the fact that women are not promoted at the same rates as men, and women make less money than men.
Why does this problem exist?
So it's multifaceted. There's many different things that I think contribute to this. But I think the most worrisome part of it relates to gender schemas or expectations that we have around men and women and how we're expected to behave. And surgery is a very male-typed occupation in that we expect men to be in that position. And in fact, there's sort of a brain teaser about this where, you know, a man and his son are in an accident and the boy presents to the emergency room and the surgeon walks in and says, I can't operate on him. He's my son. And then you're asked, how is that possible? And many people can't figure it out, the fact that the surgeon could actually be the boy's mother, because we're so stereotyped that a surgeon would be a man. And so I think we have certain expectations around how women should behave. And when we don't behave that way, it can be very difficult for us to accomplish the things that we need to accomplish. You know, that is the most difficult part of this, but there's lots of other issues, I think, that go into it.
Can you explain a little bit the term gender schema and talk a little bit about how these gender schemas impact the practice of surgery in day-to-day practice?
Sure. So gender schema is a term that I got from a book called Why So Slow by Virginia Valiant. It's a fabulous book that really presents empirical data around why there are gender inequalities across basically the workforce in the United States in particular. And she describes gender schemas as these hypotheses that we have about how we expect men and women to behave. And so the expectation is that men are what she calls agentic, or capable of autonomous action. So men make things happen, right? Women, on the other hand, are expected to be nurturing and caring and communal and much more concerned about other people. And so when women need to do things that require action, which surgery often does, people assume that they are not acting communally in acting in an agentic way. And so people don't always respond to them. And so women are in this position where we're constantly trying to find what she calls the sweet spot, where we're able to be aggressive in a sort of male stereotypical way, but at the same time have these communal characteristics that make us soft and nurturing in these things that we traditionally associate with women.
What are some of the ways in which these problems can be solved?
I think a big part of it is education and a recognition that these problems exist, because I think that if you don't experience them firsthand, you may not actually even realize that there's a problem. I think that the second thing is we need to take systemic looks at the way that we do things, for example, promotions. There are ways that other disciplines are starting to think about these things. So just as an example, one of the examples I use in my talk comes from symphony orchestras, where they recognize that there was an underrepresentation of women and underrepresented minorities in professional orchestras. And so they actually implemented blinded auditions. And in fact, they then realized that they could hear women's heels walking when they walked onto the stage. So they actually mandated that they had a carpet. And when they did that, you can see this exponential growth in the representation of women and minorities in professional symphony orchestras. And so just as an example, promotions committees, publication reviews, grant reviews, all of those things which currently are not done in a blinded way. There's some work from Molly Carnes at the University of Wisconsin where she has actually done some qualitative research looking at the ways that grants are reviewed and the different language that's used between men and women when they're the PI of a grant that's submitted. And those qualitative assessments are the way that we get grant funding. And getting grant funding is the way that we get promoted, right? And so if we're assessed according to these different value systems, it can be very challenging for women to be as successful as men.
Yeah, the most fascinating thing to me is that there's a lot of scientific data coming out now about these kinds of social issues, such as gender inequality in the professions. Can you speak a little bit more about the research that you've done and some of the empirical evidence that supports the problems that you're seeing? And what I'm getting at is you have a lot of great sort of scientific sources in the talk that you go into. And so I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit about the research that's going on out there and how
Sure.
it relates to this. Because part of the thing that's interesting is the trend that there is this scientific research about
Yep.
this. This is a very social science kind of topic. And
Mm-hmm.
to see the growth of empirical studies about this is fascinating to begin with, but in the ways that apply to medicine specifically, you know, this is the subject of JAMA articles, things like that.
It's really interesting because if you look, basically when people matriculate into medical school, it's about 50-50, so men and women. And if you look specifically within surgery, as you move up from medical student to trainee to assistant professor, associate professor, professor, chair, dean, the percentage of women goes down. And for a long time, we've been saying that that's a pipeline issue. And there's good data to suggest that actually it's not a pipeline issue, that we actually have attrition of women along the way, and that women move through that system at a slower rate than men. And so if we look even just at people who graduate from medical school intending to become board certified as general surgeons, women are less likely to finish residency and become board certified as general surgeons. If we look at what happens once they start on staff, they're less likely to get promoted at any time point you sort of look at along the way. They get smaller and NIH grants. They are less likely to be successful with NIH grants. And I think the biggest issue is around salary equity. And salary equity is incredibly complicated when it comes to surgery.
What are some of the primary issues with salary equity, and what are the primary complications as you see them?
Yeah, so the complicated thing about salary equity in surgery, in academic surgery in particular, is that most places are run by the clinical dollars that are generated. And there is a certain amount of what's called occupational segregation, so that women tend to go into surgical specialties that reimburse less, and men tend to go into surgical specialties that reimburse more. And so just based on what people do every day, there's disparities and gender that contribute to the salary gap. And then beyond that, women tend to do things that are not currently compensated in our system. So service work on committees, education, things that are expected and are needed to make an academic surgery department work, yet don't show up as part of the bottom line and therefore are not compensated. And even, again, when you look at the papers that you were referring to in JAMA and then in Annals of Internal Medicine, there were several papers that adjusted for all sorts of measures of productivity and showed that about 40% of the differences in pay according to gender are not accounted for by these different things that I've been talking about. And that's where the gender schemas come in and sort of the things that limit our ability to get promoted, to get leadership positions, and to just assume that that women need to make less money, right? There's something called the family wage, where people assume that if your husband works and you're a woman, then why would you need more money? And if you need more money, you're being selfish and asking for it. Women can't negotiate as well as men can, and they're penalized when they try to negotiate on their own behalf.
So on one hand, it seems like, you know, the problem could be solved by women negotiating and asking for more money, but you have also pointed to the fact that that itself is problematic Yep. as it relates to the gender schemas. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Again, it comes from this sort of communal expectation it comes from this communal expectation of women that we act on behalf of others and not on behalf of ourselves. And so if we go in and we are acting on behalf of ourselves and trying to negotiate for either more money or for power, which is even worse, we are basically penalized or thought negatively about.
So the very thing that you must do to advance in the profession is the very thing that you end up being punished for.
That you get punished for, right. Yeah. It's sort of the what we were just talking about, this, the double-edged sword, right? It's sort of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And so what are you supposed to do?
A lot of this discussion about gender schemas also seems to connect to some of the issues you've raised in the past about part of the debate being framed around the issue of work-life balance. Mm-hmm. Why is work-life balance not the issue here?
Work-life balance is not the issue here because work-life balance is an issue for everyone. And women are not going to be able to excel in the workplace at the same rate as men until men take as much ownership at home as women do.
So this issue here seems to go beyond surgery specifically.
Yes.
And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about why these issues are important beyond just the surgical profession. Obviously, gender equality and the pay gap is an important thing in many professions. So on one hand, this discussion is relevant to possibly other professionals who are interested in the same problems mm-hmm. in their fields. But beyond even the professionals, why should patients, why should average people in society care about these things?
Yeah, so I think that there's two issues. So the first is that there's good data coming out of other disciplines such as business that when you have more diversity in your workforce, you're more successful. So businesses that have better representation of women, more diversity in their leadership, actually have better margins. Right. So the more people you have, the more diversity you have, the better you do. So it's better for society in general if we have a workforce that's more diverse. Now, the problem is that we are in a transition period. We are in a generational transition period, right? A generation ago, in general, most families were made where one parent worked and one parent stayed home. And in general, the parent that worked was the man. And so the societal expectations of women were such that we would take care of the home. Well, now in this generation, most families have two parents that work, right? Whether that's out of need or whatever reason that may be. And when you have both parents working, we still have the same societal expectations of women. So when women are at work, they are made to feel guilty. When men think about going home, they're actually made to feel guilty. So men have this inverse societal pressure that they're supposed to care mostly about work and they're supposed to prioritize their work. And it sets up this inequality between men and women such that men who want to be home with their children are made to feel bad and women who want to be in the workplace are made to feel bad. And the reality is that both genders are in both places equally for the most part now. And so we have to figure out as a society how we deal with that and how we make it more acceptable, right? It's still not widely accepted within our society to have gender roles reversed, right? So if a husband wants to stay home and the wife is the primary breadwinner, that's still seen as something that is out of the ordinary in our society, as opposed to a setup, a family arrangement, which is accepted and the norm.
I want to ask a question now that's a little bit more historic in focus. Obviously, surgery, medicine in general, surgery in particular, has always been male-dominated, so much so that there actually, at one point, there were no women mm-hmm. in the profession. And the entry of women into the profession is really a growing trend since about the 1970s. What is your sense of this trend, despite all the problems that exist? Are there more and more women in surgery now, and it's just not enough? Or has there ever been a point at which there was a growing trend of women, and now that trend is reversing? What is your sense of women's role in entering into the profession, kind of speaking more broadly?
Sure. So women are definitely overrepresented at the trainee level and at the assistant professor level, and still very much underrepresented at the full professor and the chair level. I think that 20 years ago, it would have been fair to say it was a pipeline issue. I think that's really simplifying a much more complex issue. One of the reasons that I think right now in surgery this is taking such hold is because we are just reaching that tipping point, that 30% representation within the discipline. And we're doing it at a time when our society as a whole is starting to talk much more about gender issues, right? I mean, all you have to do is turn on the news today. And in politics and in Hollywood, we're hearing all about issues around gender equity, sexual harassment, all of these kinds of things. And so I think that surgery is at this sort of sweet spot where we're just getting the critical mass where it makes us, where it puts us in a position that we can actually talk about things that haven't been talked about previously. And it's also at a timely point where our society in general is dealing with this. And so I think that we're really in a position to think very proactively about how to change things.
It is certainly difficult not to notice that we're living in a historic moment right now where obviously, powerful men are being held to account for a lot of their behavior that before was simply unnoticed. And more importantly, we're living in a historical moment where it has captivated the news cycle for more than just a few days. The problem of the kind of sexual harassment that is getting a lot of attention right now, is this also still a problem within surgery, or is the problem more about the gender schemas and more under the surface kind of things?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I've struggled with that a lot, actually, because in my talk, I have a line where I say, you know, explicit sexual harassment is really quite uncommon. And when it happens, it's not tolerated anymore. And I've thought long and hard about whether to keep that statement in there. And I think my own personal experience is that that is the case. And there's no empirical data to suggest otherwise, that it is less common today in surgery, certainly, than it used to be.
If there is a perception, though, that the overt sexual harassment, such as mm-hmm. the kind that's in the news cycle today, is less of a problem mm-hmm. in surgery, mm-hmm. When did that trend start to change? And what might be driving the more overt stuff under the ground to create these other issues that are more important? I mean, maybe if your position has changed since the talk, that's not a relevant question, but I'll
pose it
anyway.
Yeah, so I think that the issue is that I think overt sexual harassment has become less common, number one, because women are more common in surgery, and so people are much more used to interacting with women. I think the second thing is professionalism has gotten a lot of attention within surgery and within healthcare in general. And we have notoriously been a culture that has tolerated bad behavior from each other. And it is now something that there is a lot of professional development around and a lot less tolerance of. And so I think that has allowed the overt sexual harassment to be minimized and has brought these other issues of subtle bias, which have always been there. But when you're being sexually harassed, and again, much less common, it's hard to think about the fact that you're getting paid less when you're really just trying to keep your head down and do your job. Right. And so there's some interesting data that came out in the Harvard Business Review that suggested that subtle bias is actually more damaging in a longitudinal way to an individual than overt sexual harassment or harassment based on any other characteristic. And I think that the reason for that is because if someone is saying to you or blatantly sexually harassing you, and it's very clear they're doing it because of your gender, you know why it's happening. When you are making less money or when you're not getting a promotion, and it could be due to your gender or it could be due to the fact that you don't have the right skill set, that you're not experienced enough, that, you know, any of these other things, it's much more challenging. It takes much more time and energy to try to figure out why these things are happening than when it's blatant bias or blatant harassment. The other issue is that it happens much, much, much more frequently. And so it has this additive effect over time when you're experiencing this weekly, as opposed to, again, sexual harassment, blatant sexual harassment, which tends to be much less common and in more isolated incidents than time and time again coming at you from different directions. And then the last piece of it is that you don't have a whole lot of recourse, right? Sexual harassment, we have recourse now. There are every HR department has a policy around it. You have recourse in ways that you can bring it to light, as we see with what's happening again in politics right now and Hollywood. But when it's subtle bias, you don't really have legal recourse or recourse within your institution for how to address that.
So given that subtle bias is in fact subtle, and often the person who behaves in that way is unaware perhaps that they have this bias, since you have begun talking about the issue of gender inequality in surgery and the pay gap and all of these issues, what has been the reaction from the surgical profession, especially the male members and especially more senior members?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there has been a awakening of the community to these issues. I think that many people, if they aren't married to a woman who's a surgeon or don't have a daughter who's a surgeon or someone in their immediate family with whom they have an intimate relationship to really hear about these issues, they may not even recognize that there are problems because they are subtle. And so I think that there is a huge movement right now within surgery to try to rectify these issues.
Especially in today's very team-based, team-oriented way of doing things. Everybody's working on the team, no matter what profession they're in. So I think it's very clear that good communication between all the team members on a team that provides healthcare is important for patients to receive the best possible care. Is there any way in which these kinds of gender inequalities and gender biases impact, say, male physician, female patient relationships?
Where I've seen it much more is towards female physicians.
That's really more kind of internal to the team is where this
dynamic
plays out.
No, I mean patients to female physicians.
Oh, talk about that
a little bit. So patient assumptions that female physicians are the nurse, mm-hmm. for example. I've had many conversations with female physicians as I've been talking about this, and everyone shares these stories about how, you know, you can meet a patient, have an entire hour-long preoperative consultation with them, go to do the consent form, assign the consent form, and they say, well, who's going to do the surgery? Or when do I meet the surgeon? And just this assumption that you can't be the surgeon because you're a youngish-looking female. And I think that's an experience that most women surgeons have had.
That seems there's a little bit of ageism perhaps going on there as well.
I don't think it happens to young men quite at the same level that it happens to young
women. Does it happen less to women who are older?
Since I let my hair go gray, it happens less to me, yes. But I do think that there is, a bias in the older generations. I think it happens much less with patients that are younger. And so then the question is, you know, as physicians and as surgeons, trying to put ourselves into the position of the patient who is incredibly overwhelmed, showing up in an environment that they know nothing about, where everybody's wearing white coats, everybody looks the same, they're in a very vulnerable position, and trying not to get frustrated when there might be gender schemas or gender biases that influence patients' assumptions about who you are. The problem in my mind comes when those assumptions are made by people who work within the system,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that there are complexities based on some of the cultural changes that you were talking about around team-based approaches to care and what we call the flattening of the hierarchy, right? So the making sure that everybody understands the individual roles and individual value that people in different roles bring to a team. And because of the importance of flattening hierarchy, it sort of brings up this issue of first name professional titles, right? So there's lots of data that women are much more likely to be called by their first name than doctor so-and-so. And it's really challenging because if you look at leadership and the ways that we are moving in terms of effective leadership, we know that flattened hierarchies and transformational leadership styles, right? So sort of being inspiring as opposed to being instructive in your approach to leadership is more effective. And often that's more effective if you use your first name. But when that happens and it's not done across the board, it is a source of bias in that you will find that women are more likely to be referred to by their first name and men are more likely to be referred to as doctor.
We're talking a little bit about what can be done about the problem. I want to talk a little bit more specifically about that in the sense that because there's a lot of people in the workplace that are still only just learning, especially in this historic moment that we have with powerful men being held to account for sexual impropriety, a lot of people are learning about things like gender schemas and implicit bias for the first time. Beyond general recommendations, professionally speaking, what can individual people do to address this problem in day-to-day practice?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I think number one is awareness. Number two is education. Harvard has on its website an incredibly informative set of bias tests that you can take to understand what your own individual biases are. So I think that people should go to that website and try to take that to understand where their own implicit biases lie. People who think about this a lot need to provide resources to people that are just learning about it. So I strongly recommend reading Virginia Vallien's book if you are an empirically minded academic type person, or reading, you know, some of the other more lay oriented things like Sheryl Sandberg's book, for example, that describe what some of these issues are so that you can really get your head around why we have the disparities that we do. The other thing is once you learn that these things exist, just look around you in society and look for examples where these things are happening, because you're going to see them every day. And then figuring out how you can hold yourself accountable and how you can hold other people accountable. When you see somebody doing something that's based on an implicit bias, whether it's based on gender, whether it's based on race, whether it's based on sexual orientation, that you call people out on it. And point out to them their own implicit biases. I mean, the majority of the time that these things happen, they are not happening with malintent. Everyone has implicit bias. Everyone has gender schemas and things that they expect when they look at somebody based on their appearance and how they're going to act. The challenge is in how we control those initial reactions and try to mitigate or limit the impact that they have on the way that we interact with others. And that's only going to happen through education and acknowledgement that this is something everybody has to deal with, and that it doesn't make us bad people. It's just something that we need to address.
Dr. Caprice Christian Greenberg, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts about this very important issue with us today.
Thank you.
Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories is a podcast of the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery and is produced by Amanda Brower. Our audio tech is Brian Carnell. I'm medical historian David Korostyshevsky. Join us next time on Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories.